It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Coming up on episode number 110 of Sports Day Plus. At 6:15, I'm spending three segments with stand-up comedian Nimesh Patel out of his headlining show at the Paramount Theater on Friday night. And a mere seconds, breaking down the NFL draft with one of the best in the business, Matt Miller of ESPN and ESPN.com. I am your host, Trey Elling. You can give me a follow on Twitter at Courtesy Wave and do the same for ESPN Austin at 1027 ESPN. Matt Miller is one of the main guys behind ESPN's NFL draft coverage. You can check his work out on the television networks and also through ESPN.com. And he's now nice enough to join me to help recap the 2024 NFL draft. Matt, thank you as always for the time. How you doing today?
Man, I'm doing well. Appreciate you having me back on.
Of course. Well, another NFL draft is come and gone. 5 years from now, what do you think the big storyline will be with regards to the 2024 NFL draft?
5 years, we will be through the rookie contracts of the six quarterbacks. So I think that will be the look back. Is, you know, the fastest we've ever seen six quarterbacks come off the board. And I think we'll be, you know, firmly through that evaluation period on those guys. So, you know, the numbers say that around 60% of first-round quarterbacks fail. So I think that's what's going to be fascinating is out of those six drafted, does that mean, I mean, are four, you know, bounce to another team? Are two really, really good starters? I think that'll definitely be the storyline.
What do you think has to happen in order for that Michael Penix pick to have made sense for the Atlanta Falcons in 4 or 5 years?
Nothing. Yeah, honestly, I don't know that you can make that pick make sense. I mean, so if in 4 years Michael Penix Jr. is their starter and he's a really good player, then you'd say, okay, yeah, you know, you went from one quarterback to the next, but you know, you draft a 24-year-old quarterback at number 8 overall when you already have a 36-year-old quarterback in Kirk Cousins, you're paying him $100 million. So, you know, history might be kind to this pick, you know, once we get to that point, but it's always going to feel like an overvalue or at least a poor allocation of resources to pay Kirk Cousins that much money and then immediately draft his future successor, given the fact that you drafted the oldest quarterback of the first six drafts. And I think if you were going to do that, you draft J.J. McCarthy, who's 21. Like, if you're going to draft the quarterback, you know, you go with the young guy as opposed to the guy who is, you know, very, very NFL-ready after being a six-year player in college.
Was Bo Nix a bigger reach for the Broncos than Penix was for the Falcons?
No, I don't think so. I had them rated equal, okay. Bo Nix and Michael Penix. The reason I'll say that is, like, context does matter. The Broncos had to get a quarterback in this draft. The board was wiped out. So if you don't take Bo Nix at 12, like, who do you take? And I think you have to worry about the Raiders taking him at 13 if you don't take him at 12. So, I had Bo Nix rated number 39 on my board. He goes 12. I had Penix rated 40. He goes 8. So I think it's fair to say that both were reaches on value, but when you look at positional value and need, at least the Bo Nix pick makes some sense.
What did you think of the Cowboys draft?
I didn't love it, but I think Dallas does this every year where they get a little cute at times. Tyler Guyton's a really good player. I like Guyton. I thought that was a pretty good spot for him. Neyland in the second round felt luxury to me just because I don't think that defensive end was a primary need for the team. No running back, no center. You know, they don't get a premium wide receiver in an incredibly deep wide receiver class. So they kind of missed on some of the spots that I would say they had clear needs at. But Tyler Guyton's a really good player. Nathan Thomas is a really good player. They got good players. I just think they ignored some of their needs.
Yeah, I like Cooper Beebe a lot. And if they do end up kicking him even further inside to center, then that one makes a whole lot of sense where they got him in the third round.
Yeah, I love Cooper Beebe. He's one of those picks where you look at it and you're like, all right, they might walk out of this draft with three starters on the offensive line. They really might. Famously, I hated the Travis Frederick pick when they made it, and they were absolutely right, and I was absolutely wrong. So this might be another instance of Will McClay pulling one over on me, because I do like Tyler Guyton. I just wish they had addressed running back. I wish they had grabbed, you know, a wide receiver a little bit earlier in the draft. I think that would have taken a pretty good draft to a great one. And factoring in here what they didn't do in free agency, you know, like they signed Eric Kendricks, like the only free agent move they made. So I think that adds to an offseason that's kind of confusing.
Matt, we all miss, and so it's great to hear somebody who's as expert as you are with this admit that you miss on certain guys. Do you have a all biggest miss of all time, a guy that you were convinced was either going to be huge or be a complete bust, and the opposite happened?
I thought Trent Richardson was, like, the future of the running back.
I did too, man.
NFL.
Oh, my gosh.
So, that's the one. And I tell people all the time, like, you know, I had a second-round grade on Patrick Mahomes. My scouting report on Mahomes reads good. Like, it has stood up to the test of time because it basically said, like, this dude has rare arm talent, rare creativity, but he's not ready to play in the NFL, and where he goes will determine if he's good or not, basically. So the grade on Mahomes was wrong, but the scouting report was right.
Well, in fairness, it's not like he won a ton at Texas Tech either with Cliff Kingsbury as his head coach. It was hard to decipher whether he could get to that next gear and win games in the biggest moments, which clearly he has proven to do so over time.
Yeah, absolutely. And meanwhile, Kingsbury has not. So it's one of those two. I'm old enough to remember watching Central Michigan. They had a quarterback named Dan LeFever, and I thought he was just the cat's pajamas, right? He wasn't. But his wide receiver, Antonio Brown, pretty dang good. So it sometimes, you know, over time you realize who made whom, basically, when it comes to football.
Great call. It was, an underwhelming Texans draft, and that's usually going to be the case when you don't have a first-round draft pick. But what do you think about what Houston was able to do in the draft a couple days ago?
Like you said, you have to add in, you know, that they've set the table for next year. Next year's draft class is going to be historically good on the defensive side of the ball. I think that bodes really well for what the Texans are going to do. But, yeah, I liked it. I think, you know, looking back at it now, it's like, would you have rather had pick 23? That's going to be the biggest question mark for them for the long term of, like, okay, which is more valuable? You know, the second rounder next year, would you have liked to just been there? I think Blake Fisher is really interesting because, you know, a two-year guy at Notre Dame, only played right tackle, incredibly raw, but the athletic ability is all there. I think on the offensive line, it's going to be interesting to watch. Like, what is the – who's the starting five? You know, are we going to see Titus Howard move? What happens to a guy like Kendrick Green or Kenyon Green, either player, you know, on the interior of the offensive line? I love Cade Stover. And the fact that he's going to get to learn under Dalton Schultz, I think it's great for him because they're really similar types of players. And, you know, to get – Kalen Bullock was my top safety in the draft. They get him at an exceptional value in the third round. I thought Lassiter in round two was a little bit of a reach, but we had seen the corner board really get wiped out. So it kind of makes sense because I did think that was the team's biggest need headed into the offseason.
All right, I haven't seen a 2025 mock for you just yet at ESPN.com, but those do exist across the sports media landscape. There are two Longhorns that we are currently seeing the names of in these first-round mocks next year, that being Kelvin Banks, who since his freshman season has been projected as a first-round draft pick, and Quinn Ewers really helped his draft stock out this last season as well, and hopefully another good year will leave him ripe for first-round pickings. If there is a third Longhorn that ends up as a first-round draft pick in next year's draft, Matt, who do you think that would be and why?
Oh, man, I'll go with Isaiah Bond. I think he certainly has the traits to be that type of player that pushes into that wide receiver group. The early look at next year is that it's going to be strong at receiver again. I will say Ethan Burke is my sleeper, though.
Wow.
I love Trey Moore. Like, Trey Moore, if he plays like he did at UTSA, he's going to be in there in the mix. But the flashes that I've seen from Ethan Burke have me thinking that he could be that dude that takes that, you know, the Byron Murphy-like step this year.
Yeah, you know, if Bill Belichick finds his way back to the league next offseason, because Ethan Burke does have that lacrosse background, I would put a lot of money on Ethan Burke ending up with whatever team Bill Belichick is coaching, because we know how fond he is of guys who go from lacrosse to football.
Yeah, absolutely. And fits that the model as well, you know, like a long, kind of linear outside pass rusher. We know the Longhorns. That was a big thing last year, that lack of outside pass rush. So Burke's going to have a lot of opportunities this year, but dude, Trey Moore's tape last year is so good. So I can't wait to see what he does this season.
No doubt. He is Matt Miller, doing an exceptional job covering the NFL draft for ESPN TV stations, also ESPN.com. And occasionally he's nice enough to join me to talk about these things. Matt, thank you as always for the time, man. Have a great offseason.
I appreciate you, man. Thanks so much.
Coming up, I'm spending three segments with stand-up comedian Steve Byrne, who's headlining at the Comedy... Coming up, I'm spending three segments with Nimesh Patel ahead of his headlining show at the Paramount Theater on Friday night, right here on Sports Day Plus.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Steve Byrne is a longtime stand-up comedian who is bringing that craft to Austin this weekend, headlining at the Comedy Mothership. Shows Friday through Monday now, and I mentioned the Monday show because this was just added yesterday, and there are still tickets left. Steve is headlining the Fat Man Room. That's the bigger room at the Mothership. Let me tell you, folks, it is well worth the price of admission. I saw Steve at Creek in the Cave a couple of months ago. The place was half full, and he burned it to the ground. He is that funny. So go to comedymothership.com to snag those tickets that remain for his Monday show. All the rest of the shows throughout the weekend are sold out. Steve is now nice enough to join me to talk comedy and more. Steve, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
Good. Just woke up. So this is comedian's life. I was up late and like a dip. And just waking up. This is nice. It's good to be back in Austin, though. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, you know, they say the American dream is the white picket fence and the wife and the kids. But the real American dream is getting up at 6 o'clock at night and putting your pants on by 6:30.
Well, that, by the way, this is early. My superpower is sleep. I absolutely love sleep. I could sleep anywhere. I could sleep on a sidewalk. We were on a USO tour in Afghanistan. I slept on the airfield. I literally could fall asleep anywhere. And that's what I have in common with my audiences. They just fall asleep. So.
I was listening to an interview of you and Bobby Kelly from back in 2017, and he said then that those USO tours that you guys went on are still some of his all-time favorite shows. Is that how you feel about things too, considering how much of a military background you have within your family?
It's funny you bring up the military background. My father served, my uncle served, my brother served. Like, I never served. So I think I have this resonant guilt to do these USO tours. So I've done about 10 of them. And I'll tell you, I do think they're some of the best crowds you could do because of the fact that they're so far removed from home. Usually when you're Iraq, Afghanistan, Middle East, that's primarily where I've gone. But even Europe, Asia, just to give people some semblance of home, they're just really appreciative of it. So yeah, I mean, there were shows we did in 2004, like at the height of the war, of the Iraq war and Afghanistan, where people are literally coming back from firefights and rescuing their friends and said, I just drove onto the base. I heard people laugh and I run over here and you guys completely distracted me from what I just saw. And I was laughing and I just, you know, when you hear things like that, you're like, wow, that's crazy. That is absolutely crazy. But I think that's the power of just communal laughter, not just laughter, but communal when it's done with a sense of, even though you might've seen that guy at the mess hall and him at the food hall, like you're all together is, you know, you're just kind of laughing over these commonalities that we're trying to drive home. So I would agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a reason why we're seeing a sort of resurgence in stand-up comedy over these last few years is because we were all so fractured in that COVID era. And there's nothing that brings people together like the ability to laugh together, but also being able to laugh about our differences too. It's hard to talk about those things sometimes unless you're in that official format where somebody is standing on stage telling jokes, assuming that they're telling good jokes too, of course. But when somebody does it right, there's nothing better. And the best evidence of that, in my opinion, and I've seen 50 plus shows in my life, 50 stand-up shows or so. I don't know if I've ever laughed harder than I did seeing you at the Creek in the Cave a couple months back. The room was...
thank you. That's very kind.
Creek in the Cave is a weird room. I've seen so many good comedians there, and sometimes it's only half full. The room was half full that night. Mm-hmm. You burned the place to the ground. It was so impressive to see. Everybody was cracking up, and it was like the room may as well have been full. That's how funny you were that night. And so I set all that up because I was getting ready to have you on and chastise people for not acting fast enough to get to see you at the Mothership this weekend. But you just added a Monday show. There's actually tickets available for that right now, VIP seating and general admission. And so people, if you have nothing to do on Monday and you're looking to go laugh your ass off, Steve is well worth the price of admission. As a matter of fact, I will put this guarantee out right now. If you buy tickets and don't enjoy yourself, I will pay you back for those tickets. That's how confident I am that you go to that show and you'll watch Steve just eviscerate the crowd. He does like a sort of a stand-up monologue that you would see on late night television, but he does it with like a Mitch Hedberg twisted sense of humor to things. And then he tells more traditional stories as well. So kudos to you for being on top of your game right now, man.
Well, thank you. That guarantee is limited to you. I don't guarantee that.
That's right.
So don't come follow me after the show. No, but I really appreciate that, especially anybody who lives in the Austin market nowadays. You're exposed to so much great comedy. Even the younger comics there are, I think, a lot better than the comics, for example, in Los Angeles, because in LA it's such limited stage time. But in Austin, you know, for as powerful as Mothership is, there's still a ton of like offshoot clubs and rooms you could do. So these comics that move there are getting up, you know, 3-4 times a night, which I think is so much more impactful and helps you grow so much quicker than somebody who's in LA that's getting up maybe once or twice every 2 days. So
we talked a little bit about it last time too. LA, you're also dealing with a very sensitive crowd and people are a little bit more open to laughing, even at seemingly offensive subject matter. When you're talking about stand-up comedy, I mean, it wasn't necessarily the reason why you guys moved from Nashville, but I'm sure it was a lot more liberating for you moving to Tennessee versus having to play by a different set of rules in California.
Yeah, I mean, look, California is great. LA is great. The comedy scene is amazing. I mean, you have iconic stalwarts such as, you know, the Comedy Store, sure. The Improv. They're, you know, you feel the history when you go into those venues and you see the history on the walls. You can actually smell the history in the Comedy Store, which is not that great. But nonetheless, it's great to be a part of those venues. But yeah, I think like when you're doing things that stray from, you know, the echo chamber that is Southern California, and maybe you have a different perspective where you're kind of dumping on the left, it's not as appreciated. And sometimes, you know, as you saw with those monologue jokes, they can go pretty beyond because of the nature of just bending the joke or bending the note, you know. Yeah, you hear a lot more groans in Los Angeles, but like Nashville, it's what I like about it. And I think this is similar to Austin probably, is that you have a blue center, which is the city, which is like most places. And then as you go out to the peripheral surrounding area, it becomes more red. So there's this great hybrid of like thoughts and ideas, a diversity of thought, right? Which California is severely lacking. So you can do this kind of great hybrid. At least I do, where, you know, if I spend 2 minutes dumping on this guy, then I'm going to swing the pendulum and do 2 more minutes dumping on this guy or whoever it is, you know, the disparity politically. So I try to be very fair and balanced with my jokes. The issue, I think, is that, you know, it doesn't matter, because if you piss somebody off, that's all they're going to remember. So I'm still trying to be balanced, but you know, it doesn't always work. I think they only hear what they want to hear.
Well, if you're going to piss somebody off, you may as well try and piss the extremes on both sides off too. And I know there's political comedians that really go after one side or the other, but in my opinion, the best political comedy pokes holes in both sides of whatever the ridiculousness is of a given issue, because the reality in true life is that there is a lot of nuance to these subjects that is never discussed when you're talking about the broadcast, whether it's on Fox News, CNN, or something like that. I mean, it takes longer form conversations to get into those things, and TV segments last, 6 to 8 minutes before it's that next commercial break.
Right, right. Well, look, to your point earlier, I think that the reason that comedy is bigger than ever, I think the reason it's so much more communal than ever is that, you know, speaking of Los Angeles and California, Hollywood doesn't make comedies anymore. Hollywood isn't making, you know, I tried to think about, I was having a conversation with some friends. I was like, the last great R-rated film, to me at least, is either The Hangover or Bridesmaids. And other than that, and I'm talking communal, you may have seen an R-rated independent film that's kind of like really great or splashy, but the last two big major hits in the comedy space to me are those two films. And since Hollywood got so woke and scared to push the envelope, which is where you always saw the most kind of like grandiose forms of comedy. Now it's dead. They don't do it anymore. And I think people still need that outlet. They need to hear like these things that are so shocking that they need a release from the everyday life because of inflation, because the state of nature of politics, because the state of like, you know, campus riots and all this stuff. People are like, I just need to laugh. I need to get the hell out of this and go laugh. And so I think that's why comedy clubs have become almost like these medicated outlets for the general public where they can go and hopefully just like take a deep breath and go, oh, okay, somebody's making fun of this again. So this is fine. And I think in that regard, I think it's very cathartic for the general public.
Yeah, I was talking to Robert Smigel a couple months back. And one question I like to ask parents is what they think the most difficult thing is about parenting in 2024, because there's a countless answers seemingly. He gave such a unique response, but I think it speaks to what you're talking about. He said the loss of the shared experience in a movie theater. And he was talking about that for parents and kids, but that exists in terms of those comedies as well. Yeah, you can go see serious movies with one another. You want to go with your friends to see movies where you can crack up, and you think back years later about going to see Old School or Bridesmaids or Tropic Thunder or Something About Mary. So many examples, and obviously that exists for parents and kids too. There are some options now, but it's legitimately, and I say this because I have a 9 and 7 year old, it's like one option for 3 or 4 weeks, and then it's that next option. So it may not even be that appealing of a movie, but that's your one option that you can go see, and then you have to wait a month for the next one.
Movies were unique. Movies were special. Movies were something where you would get in your car, your parents would drop you off, you know, when you're a kid or even in your college years, you go and you spent money. Even if you spent a dollar on something, you're invested in it, right? You spent money on it. And now Netflix and all the streamers, I think particularly Netflix, they've just carpet bombed the marketplace with crap, to be honest with you.
Steve, let's continue this conversation on the other side. I like where you're heading here, and I think there's more meat on this bone, but we are up on a commercial break right now with Steve Byrne headlining at the Comedy Mothership this weekend. That includes a just-added Monday show that still have tickets left. Go to comedymothership.com. Coming up, more with Steve Byrne on the other side.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Back with the hilarious Steve Byrne. He is a longtime stand-up comedian who is headlining at the Comedy Mothership this weekend. Yesterday, because things sold out through the weekend, they added a Monday show for this coming Monday. It's an 8 p.m. start time. You can get tickets right now. Just check. They're still available. ComedyMothership.com. I saw Steve at the Creek in the Cave a couple of months ago. Legitimately one of the funniest shows I've ever seen. So I highly recommend you check him out this Monday at the Mothership. And Steve, we're just having an interesting conversation about the changing landscape of going to see movies in theaters. And that has largely to do with the streamers and how they've really taken control over the filmmaking process. There's something you wanted to add to that as well, specifically regarding comedies.
I mean, I cannot remember the last time I saw a fantastic film. I'm not talking about, you know, limited series or anthology series or anything. Just a movie that everybody talked about that was done by a streamer. I can't think of one. I'm sure there is one out there, but that's how, think about it. Like, even when I ask you a question, you're kind of staring up. We should be able to rattle off 5 or 10.
Yeah.
I mean, think of all the hundreds of millions of dollars they spend, but tens of millions on individual films. And I think there's the huge disparity because the studio films are still making great films. I mean, I just saw Dune 2. I heard great things about it. I went and saw it, and I had that great experience of seeing it in IMAX and the THS sound system. And I was just like, this is a film. This is amazing. Maverick, that's an experience you're not going to get at home, but that movie put movies back on the map. And seeing that was just a great story. There was no agenda to it. It wasn't trying to be woke. They weren't trying to kill off the old guy who was just a peripheral, like Star Wars made that mistake so many times.
Yeah.
Like, it was just a fantastic shared experience, and everybody saw that movie. Everybody. And everybody talked about it for weeks. And I think that's what we're missing, and it just... I think it's so hard for Hollywood to thread that needle because they keep getting in their way of being woke and having an agenda and making sure you know, you got to have six black people in this role, but ignore all the other races. But you have to have black, because if you don't, you're racist. I mean, you turn on every commercial and it's, they're just hammering home these like mixed relationships and everything. Just like, guys, just tell a good message in the 30 seconds you have, or tell a really fantastic story. That's the agenda. The agenda isn't, you know, I'm going to shake up the Star Wars universe because, you know, I'm a female and, you know, this is male dominated. It's just like, nobody cares about that. People want to go and get away from all that. People want a great story. And I think that's sorely been missed in with the message with all the streamers.
The pendulum does swing back and forth, though, and I'm starting to wonder if we're getting close to the pendulum swinging back in the direction of people loosening up with regards to comedies that end up in theaters that take more chances. There were a few examples that popped up during South by Southwest this year. There's one called The Gutter. I'm not sure if it has a release date just yet, but it's a bowling flick, and it was one of the talks of the festival. Like, wow, I can't believe they went there and it was a funny comedy and they took chances. Right. Even the people covered the red carpet, people on the red carpet that were in the film were like, when I read the script, I was like, I can't believe that there's still a script like this in this day and age. And it's why I wanted to be a part of the project. Mark Norman and Sam Morril are writing a buddy comedy. I could see that one having that sort of teeth. And I know that the last time we talked, you said that you were working on getting a film going that had to do with that really bad Caltech basketball program from what, back in the 70s and 1980s. Are you any further along with that? And does that have that sort of potential too, Steve?
Yeah, that's a film about Caltech's losing streak. So Caltech has a basketball team. They went 0 for 30 years. It's one of the longest streaks in NCAA history.
That was 0 for 30 years, not 0 for 30, 0 for 30
years.
Not 0
for 30, 0 for 30 years. Yeah. So they, a new coach comes in and he's realized he's in way over his head. So they're not going to the playoffs, not winning the championship. He's just getting his team to just win once, just win one game. That's how bad they are. So that's the whole film. It's definitely comedic. It's definitely a sports film. It's, you know, a lesson in fortitude and perseverance. There's comedic elements to it for sure, but we are in the middle of casting it right now.
Okay.
So that's the good news. Very excited about that. Got the funding, all that stuff. And then, you know, what we were just talking about, I had done a documentary on The Amazing Jonathan a few years ago.
Really good.
And that documentary, it's available on YouTube for free. You just type in Always Amazing, and it's done from Jonathan's perspective. But the whole film, the whole documentary is about Jonathan and this unorthodox relationship he has with the, you know, he hires an 18-year-old boy to come to Vegas and be his manager. And this kid's now in charge of a drug addict who's a headlining magician in Las Vegas who, you know, any vice you have is available to you 24 hours a day. And Jonathan's not a 9-to-5 guy. So, you know, obviously I've heard all these stories from Joel over the years. So I was talking to a producer who I'm working on the Caltech one with, and we were talking about the Jonathan film. He's like, boy, you write that, we could get that made. So I knew all the stories so well. I knew exactly how to craft it. So I banged out a script in probably 2-3 months. And so I think this is one of those hard R films where you're like, holy, like they're really going there. But the thing is, like, none of it's made up. That's the differentiating factor between this film and so many others. Like, you know, you go to Wedding Crashers, you see Knocked Up. It's like, you know, these things are like, well, it's just so ridiculous. But this thing, it's like, there is not a scintilla. There's nothing that we did that I wrote that we're going to do that is made up in this film. And this is 100% a passion project. And I have no doubt we're going to get this thing done. It is, it's definitely the best work I've ever done. And I'm looking forward to getting that going.
That's a big statement there, because you've done some great stuff and stand up and then filmmaking too. Is there a detail from that story that you can share with the people as a sort of enticement for whenever it ultimately comes out, other than the 30-year losing streak, obviously?
You mean with the Caltech?
Yeah.
With the Caltech, I think...
Wait, look, I'm sorry, were you talking about the Caltech script or a script specific to the Amazing Jonathan?
No, I was talking about a script about The Amazing Jonathan.
Okay.
That one I wrote, turned it in. We're in the process now of getting the wheels in motion for that one.
Oh, so this is separate from the documentary then. This is something that's going to be based on a real story?
Yeah, it's based on all the real stories that there. You know, when I was doing that doc about Jonathan, there were so many things I couldn't put in. Mm. There were so many things that we had to leave out because narratively it didn't fit into the story we were telling for that film, right? But this one, it's Joel's experience of showing up in Las Vegas, tending to, you know, a mid-30-year-old, you know, drug addict in Las Vegas, and all the trials and tribulations Joel went through in just keeping him on track, like getting him to the Greek, right? It's like he had to get him to the show every single night. And like the things that Jonathan had him do on a daily basis, or he would just throw a Joel. It just like, you're like, how did you do this? Like you did that? I mean, when Joel showed up 2 weeks into his job, Joel had to go in and negotiate almost a $2 million contract for Jonathan for the year. So Jonathan had an 18-year-old kid dress up and walk in and talk to the president of the Gold Nugget and say, we want bus ads. We want $2 million. We want merch table. You don't get a cut of it. And if you can't meet our demands, then you can. And Joel was at this point, as Jonathan said, to stand up, look at everybody in the eyes and scream, you can f- off. And then you have to walk out and slam the door. And so Joel is an 18-year-old kid. He's like, what the f- do you want me to do? And so Jonathan had him rehearse it. And of course, Joel botches it and it's done in a great way. But it, I mean, it's like, it's true. It's like, who in the right mind would say, I'm going to take $2 million and bet on an 18-year-old kid to get this deal done? I mean, that's crazy, but that's what a drug addict does. But at the same time, Jonathan was the most, everybody has a friend that can drink that you would never know, like they're drunk, like yeah. Bert Kreischer. Jonathan was one of those guys you would never even know that he's even on drugs. He was a functioning drug addict, and he seemed to have his wherewithal, especially when he was performing. So just another aspect of the film we delve into as well.
Well, you and I are of a similar age. We were not of a similar age. We still are the similar age. So I'm sure that you were watching that amazing Jonathan stand-up set late night on Saturdays. You were in junior high and high school and just blown away at what he's getting away from. I mean, he was making fun of the fact that he was a drug addict in a sense with the cocaine bit that he did.
Sure. He had that big bowl and a big oversized straw, yep. And he'd take it and he'd go like that. And there was a vacuum that was sucking the white powder down from the bottom. But it looks like he's, you know, doing cocaine, but he's really doing cocaine. There was cocaine in this straw that he would snort during his show. So people have no idea. And again, just another clever way of him getting away with things.
Super esoteric. Wow, that's wild.
Yeah.
So I'm burying the lead here because last time we spoke, I was asking you who you would rather have between Kenny Pickett or Mason Rudolph. Congratulations. You don't have to have either of those quarterbacks on your Pittsburgh Steelers next year, Steve. You get the choice of Russell Wilson or Justin Fields. Who would you rather see under center in the 2024 season?
I'd prefer to see Russell take the reins. Fields kind of sitting in the wings, learning from such an experienced guy. You know, you got to eat the ego for a little bit, but just know there's light at the end of the tunnel. He signed for a year. Learn from this guy, garner the experience, and, you know, God willing, he stays healthy. You come back in 2026 or 2024, whatever, at the end of next season, and you have that experience, and now it's your team.
He is Steve Byrne headlining at the Comedy Mothership this weekend. That includes a just added Monday show. You can grab tickets at comedymothership.com. Coming up, one more segment with Steve Byrne on the other side.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling. It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elling.
Final segment with the hilarious Steve Byrne. He's headlining at the Comedy Mothership this weekend. They just added a Monday show. Tickets available, comedymothership.com. That's this Monday, May 6th. Well worth the price of admission. So, Steve, since the last time you and I spoke a few months ago, I talked to Bobby Kelly about a month ago, and I asked him about the story involving him taking your SNL demo tape that he got access to because you borrowed his camera and just doing something that completely embarrassed you at a roast of Patrice O'Neill. It was vicious. It was crazy. I mean, you want to talk about thick skin. You've got some serious thick skin for going through something like that and being friends with that guy. But I asked him about it, and he actually showed remorse. But he showed remorse with the caveat. And the caveat is Steve Byrne was a jerk to me, too. And he mentioned something
about him. He's out of his mind. This is what Bobby does. Bobby's a snake. I love Bobby Kelly, but he's a snake. Bill Burr. Do you think this guy is watching Hallmark movies? Bill Burr said to this day, it's the meanest thing he's ever seen in comedy. That tells you something, okay?
His caveat was that there was something that happened in Vegas where Nichols got slapped out of his hand, and you were the guy who slapped the Nichols out, and he had to pick Nichols up off the ground right before he was headlining a show or something. Do you have any recollection of this?
This is when you won actual coins, right, in Vegas. Now everything's on a card.
Yeah.
Bobby won $50 in Nichols. And they come out and you get those little buckets. And Bobby's like, yeah, dude, I just won. I won. Look at me. I'm a winner. I'm like, oh, that's awesome, man. So he's like, I'm cashing in. So I'm like, oh, I'll walk with you. So he walks over and I just smacked the bottom of it. And I just saw all these nickels fly up. And he just stood there with that dumb lip hanging down. He goes, duh. That was one of my favorites. Him and Jim Norton one time where walking through Hell's Kitchen, because they lived in Hell's Kitchen. I lived in Hell's Kitchen. Sundays, I would go play roller hockey with Rick Moranis, for example. Like, all these guys would get together and play roller hockey.
Say, with Park. Rick so Moranis? Fun.
Yeah, he lived right off of Central Park with his boys. So him and his son would come, and we'd all play just roller hockey. There was a good group of us that would play together and just kind of goof off.
Hearing that Rick Moranis can rollerblade does not surprise me. Hearing that he played roller hockey is a little bit surprising. Good for Rick Moranis.
Well, he's Canadian, right? He's Strange true. Brew, remember? So,
yeah.
So he, really good hockey player too, pretty fast. Mm. I broke my stick, right? So if you're rollerblading in New York and you have a stick, you're a hockey player. If you're rollerblading and you don't have a stick, you're a guy rollerblading, okay? So I'm rollerblading back, and I'm praying to God I don't see anybody because I know I'm going to get it. And the two worst people I could see are Bobby Kelly and Jim Norton. And they see me at the end of the sidewalk, and I see them, and they are dying laughing. They are immediately laughing, looking at me, and I'm just kind of coasting by, and they just came out of Starbucks. And I go to skate in between them as they're laughing, and I smack both their coffees out of their hands. And I kept skating, and then I turned around, and Bobby was on the ground laughing, and Norton was against the wall laughing. And I was like, all right, good, I got him. that was one of my favorite memories of those guys.
That is great. Do you have any expectations for the Mothership this weekend? It's obviously gotten a ton of hype in the year or so that it's been open. You did not perform there when you were in Austin at the start of the year, so this is going to be pretty fresh for you.
Yeah, I didn't. I didn't want to go while I was at Creek and Cave because I was enjoying my experience at Creek and Cave.
Yeah,
and I was really enjoying getting to meet all the younger comics out there and getting to talk to them. And then my good friend Tone Bell, who lives in Austin, who's, I would say to this day, I enjoy my drinking. There's quite a few comics that enjoy their drinking. Tone Bell is in the heavyweight class of drinkers. I've never seen anything like it in my life. And I think I can throw him back pretty well. But man, this dude, we had some good nights in Austin. So that was a part of it where I was just like, I'm going to go to Mothership. I heard so much about Mothership. I'm a big Comedy Store guy. I keep hearing all about all these great little nods. So I'm like, I'm going to enjoy the victory lap when I go there myself and get to really see it and enjoy it when I'm there on my own weekend. So I was holding out, but I'm looking forward to it. I hear fantastic things. I know all the shows are sold out. So they added that show Monday. Yeah. So that'll be That'll be fun. Yeah, I think it's just a great comedy vibe. It's a great comedy city. And again, I think when I go there, I think they're so used to seeing regimented kind of like one gear comics. Whereas I, like you were alluding to earlier, I love starting off with crowd work. I love going to monologue jokes. I love going to standard stand-up comedy, traditional, and then I love doing that interactive piece I have at the end. I think it's just like when people come, they're seeing a multifaceted show as opposed to you sitting there and watching a comic where, after 15, 20 minutes, you can go set up, punch, set up, dark, set up, dark. And you kind of start seeing their rhythm. And I think those are the comics I always tried to avoid being. I try to be somebody who can kind of shift gears on you pretty quickly.
It was not the comedian's fault, but I went and saw Eric Griffin over the weekend, and we went and saw The Late Show, and I'm an old guy at this point. I mean, you're asking me to stay up until 12 o'clock at night. I'm starting to get tired, unfortunately. So I was, it was a great set, but I was starting to get worn down in the last like 15 to 20 minutes. And it was still a great end. He had a good closer, but for your show, I'm not going to have any choice. Now I'm also probably going to be pretty close to the stage as well. So I'll get to see you eviscerate people who are sitting right on the stage too, which is going to be a lot of fun.
There are times where even I say to myself, like, holy, like I can't believe I'm saying this. I gotta stop, man. And then you're like, oh my God, I'm getting paid for this. This is my job. This is crazy. But it's also like, I think to do crowd work, I think, oh, I'm just gonna talk to the crowd. It's like all those gears I'm talking about, those are things you gotta work on. Like Jeff Ross is amazing at roasting because he specifically went out to be like, I'm gonna work on roasting. So, if you ask me to roast somebody, it's like that is not one of my specialties. It's something I have a slight foundation on, but crowd work, I mean, yeah, 100%.
Oh, that's
I just
interesting.
think,
I would assume that those two things would translate, but that's not necessarily the case. Interesting. Okay.
no. I roasting is a very specific art, very specific art, such as crowd work is, such as, one-liners, such as storytelling. Bert Kreischer's an amazing storyteller, right? I wouldn't say I'm a great storyteller. I've had fantastic stories that have happened to me, and I take them on stage. I'm like, I can't figure this one out. But you put that story in Bert Kreischer's hands, he's amazing. Now, if I ask him to give me 10 one-liners on, Biden's trip or time with the King of Jordan, that's probably his, not his forte, right? But I spent the last 7 years working on one-liners, and I spent the last 15 years working on crowd work. So it's like all those things you're seeing that are well executed on stage. It's like, no, I put the time in. I wasn't just up there one note doing just my regimented act. So it's like there's a reason those things are clicking.
All right, last question now, Steve. I love stand up. You obviously love stand up too. What do you love about stand up?
God, what do I love about stand up? It sounds like it'd be an easy question to answer, right? I love stand up for so many reasons. But I think what I ultimately love stand up for truly is that a stranger, me, can walk into a room and take something you write down on an airplane and bring it up into a room that night. And it's a thought, it's an idea. And then all of a sudden, it's a joke. It's something that's written down. This isn't funny. But the minute I execute it on stage, people laugh. And again, it's the fact that there's this shared communal experience of like a stranger talking to a room full of strangers. Now, you may know me, but you don't know me. I'm still a stranger, right? But I'm going in and divulging a thought that bubbled up just a bit ago or a few months ago that's a little more well-crafted. And then there's a room full of 300 to 500 to 700 strangers that all take that thought and think, oh, that's pretty funny. And there's this shared laugh. And I'm telling you, there's no better feeling in the world than that moment. And that high is done hopefully 60 times in an hour at the least. I don't know, I think just like doing something where you're giving everybody together is just laughing. It's like, what better job is there in the world than that? Like you're making people laugh. You're giving them the emotion that is positive, right? That It's like, how do you make somebody laugh? I don't know. I still don't. It's hard. It's really hard to make people laugh. But when you can do it and you do it right, it's just the greatest feeling in the world. I love it.
All right. If you're watching and or listening right now, you have a chance to see Steve Byrne at what I would argue is one of, if not the best comedy club on the planet. Monday, May 6th. It is an 8 p.m. show in the Fat Man at the Comedy Mothership. Go to comedymothership.com. You can also check out Steve's work beforehand if you would like. Does a great job with clips on social media. That's at Steve Byrne Live. Or go to punchup.live/Steve-Byrne to see more extended cuts. You can also check out a lot of that on his YouTube channel as well. And that last name is spelled B-Y-R-N-E. Steve, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for the time. I'm looking forward to that Sunday night show. Good luck to your liver with tone this weekend.
But luckily, he's leaving Friday, so I only have to batter myself up Thursday. But yeah, I'm looking forward to coming in. Austin's always a great town, and I love that you can just get hammered and then just walk out, and there's a food truck right there to soak up all the booze. So I'm really looking forward to it.
Food truck, there's hobos with machetes. You get it all on 6th Street. So good luck with that part of it too.
That's right. Okay. Well, I appreciate it, buddy. Thanks again for having me.
You got it, man. Thanks, man. Safe travels.
All right, Trey. Take care. We'll see you Sunday, buddy.
You too. That is it for another edition of Sports Day Plus. Stay tuned tomorrow. My guest will include Matt Miller of ESPN talking about the NFL draft and the hilarious Nimesh Patel, head of his headlining shows at the Paramount Theater on Friday night. Until then, have yourselves a great rest of the evening and hook 'em.
It's Sports Day Plus with Trey Elliott.